Mics are live. We're going to start.
You know that's what I do, right?
Afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senator Dibble, we're going to take up House File 183. And this is one of those bills that we passed out last year. And by operation of Senate Rule 47, got returned to the committee of last activity. So we're back on the agenda here today. Senator Dibble, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleased to be back in front of Judiciary with what was Senate File 211, now is House File 183. Mr. Chair and members, this is the bill that deals with access to public data by public employees. Shorthand is the driver's license data bill, although it deals with more than just driver's license databases, but it was triggered by a couple of things. One is, of course, the incidents that we've all read about in the media, the numerous instances where either an individual or many individuals' driver's license records were accessed by public employees for purposes other than the job or the task that they had at hand. And then also, kind of concurrently, the legislative auditor conducted a program evaluation on this subject and came forward with a number of recommendations. So there was some indication that these problems were brewing and they were cropping up over the last few years that triggered the legislative auditor's examination of this matter, and then more cases came rolling in that we were reading about in the newspaper. So we developed this bill to try to respond to some of the legislative auditor's recommendations. I don't think it captures all of them, but it at least gets us started on buttoning up some of the shortcomings that we have and how we administer this function and this task. I'll run through the bill very quickly. I don't have anyone to testify. I'm guessing other people are here to speak to the bill.
Senator Dibble, I'll just note that procedurally what happened is the House passed their bill off the floor, sent it to the Senate, and so what's happened since that time is we're working with the House file, but the original Senate language, as we sent it to the floor last time, has now been inserted into the House file.
Correct.
So what we have before us today is the same language that this committee passed out last year. It's the Senate version of the language.
So I can not reacquaint the committee with the language if you don't want me to.
We do have at least one new member of the committee since last year, so if you just real quickly reacquaint us, that'd be helpful.
All right, very good. I'll do it very, very quickly. So in this first section, that's language that was brought forward by Senator Ortman. It was a concern articulated by Sheriff Stanek. He is unhappy because his data has been accessed and he can't find out who did it. So this would allow anyone whose data has been accessed for any reason other than investigatory purposes to find out who's looking at their data. Even if it's accessed for the purpose of their job, doesn't matter, you can ask who's looking at your data. In the second section, this just kind of buttons up the language around making sure that when folks are accessing data, they have access to a database. They're doing so while they're at work or in the course of their duties for the intended purposes. And then it says that if there's a sort of an interagency or intergovernmental agreement, in other words, if one entity kind of controls or owns the database and is allowing other units of government access to that database, which is the case with driver's license data, for example, that there's a model policy that incorporates the procedures and make sure that that everyone is abiding by that standard. Section 3, this is where we bring all units of government under these requirements. We delete the term state agencies, say government entities, so cities, et cetera, would now be captured and have these responsibilities that are outlined. And then it makes clear that using data for purposes for which it is not intended is identified as a definition of a breach of security of the data. And that is also made true for contractors of governmental units. So it doesn't have to be just government employees, but employees and entities that are contracted with by government. Some more conforming language in the next paragraph. We also button up the term unauthorized person. An unauthorized person it just makes it clear that that's a person. It's similar to the breach of data security. If you're using the data for the purpose for which it wasn't intended, we just bring that into that definition. In subdivision 2, this whole subdivision lays out a process by which folks can be informed of a unauthorized access to their data and some of the steps that the unit of government would have to go through in communicating the results of an investigation to them. That's been the source of a tremendous amount of frustration by the public and others, identified as a shortcoming by the legislative auditor. So it kind of lays that out. You can read that for yourself. But it basically says that folks need to be informed in the level of detail to which they need to be informed, et cetera. It provides for some public notice, some public posting of the results of an investigation. And then in subdivision 4, it lays out some alternatives for individual notice to the individuals in question. If there's a whole lot of people and it becomes financially burdensome to a governmental entity to notify all of those folks individually with their own letter by mail, there's some alternatives for them, posting on a website, et cetera. Coordination with consumer reporting agencies, that's just conforming language to make sure all units are captured, not just state government. And subdivision 6, an annual review of security, make sure that security procedures are up to snuff.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Senator Dibble, and Mr. Chair, thank you. I think you were just referring to a line 2.28. My question is, when you ask for it to be delivered by mail or email, I think what you're asking for is a written copy, not a voice copy. I'm probably being pretty picky here, but you know, on an email, how you can just throw a voice recording. That's not what you're looking for. I wonder if written, or maybe it does say written, and I just didn't read it well. Any thought on that,
Senator Dibble?
I'm sorry, Senator Hall. Which line are you looking at?
2.28 and 2.29. The request would have to come delivery. And maybe it would be a written request.
I'm working off my bill. If someone could bring up to me the paper that you're
reading. Let's make sure we're working off the same page, yeah. Members. Staff has handed out the current versions of everything, not in your packet. It's got them on the front page.
Okay.
It says Senator Bach from the Committee on Rules and Administration, to which was referred. So that's the document that we should be working off.
I don't have that document.
Okay, well,
I'm just working off my bill.
I'm sure it's the same thing.
Right, but we just have different
numbers.
Members
have this in front of it.
Could a staff member please bring up what you're looking at to me?
Sure.
Thank you.
And so on the upper right-hand corner, it says Senate File 211, and then what's included in there is the 211 that we passed out, and then appended to the back of that is the House language, or House File 183. So that's what was taken out of the shell, and the Senate language was put back into the shell.
Okay, I think I'm looking at 3.14.
3.14.
Let me make
of
sure
the
here.
Bill that we have in front of us, 3.16.
Yes. And were we there already? Is that where we were at?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All I'm saying there is, I think you're looking for a written copy. I think sometimes when you get a voice on something, with email you can get a voice, and that is not what you're looking for. Like, again, I'm saying maybe I'm being too picky there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, you're not being too picky. I think that's a. I'm just reading the full paragraph. I'm sure we're not already providing for that. So the notification must be made to any individual who is the subject of the data, whose private or confidential data was or is reasonably believed to have been acquired, and must inform that a report will be prepared. So your question is the initial contact, not the report at the end of the investigation.
Correspondence is written.
Notice
right.
to the individual.
I think that's a reasonable question, and I don't think that's really specific.
If staff could help
here.
Us how to do a verbal amendment.
Just add the word written.
Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chair, members, well, I'm looking at the 3.16 reference to email, but that's where they're actually getting a report emailed to them, and I'm not sure if there was another spot, too, that talked about email.
Well, Ms. Pontius,
Senator Dibble.
If I understand Senator Hall's question correctly, it's around the initial notification to the individual that their private or confidential data was or is reasonably believed to have been acquired by an unauthorized person. And we're not specific about how that initial notification occurs. The language you just mentioned indicates that they can either have the report at the other end of the episode delivered in written form, either by email or on paper. So how would we handle, or what would be your assumptions about the initial contact when someone's being notified that something is afoot?
So maybe in both situations, thank you, Mr. Chair, on 3.11, it'd be a written notification. The other on 3.15, it'd be a written report. Again, is that just understood?
So, Mr. Chair, I think we're okay at the other end of the process upon conclusion of the investigation. What I would maybe suggest is on 3.10, must disclose, insert after the word disclose on 3.10, the words in writing, must disclose in writing any breach of the security of the data. That works.
Well, Senator Dibble, that's a different issue. That's disclosure, not necessarily to whom. Line 3.11 has to deal with the notification to the subject.
So, Mr. Chair, then maybe after the term notification must be made in writing.
The person receives the notification, and
email is written.
It's possible that your data has been compromised. An investigation, then there's a report that you.
If you're going to add written in there somewhere, it's clarification, notification in writing.
I just don't want any label. I just want to.
No. He's talking about
You just don't want someone calling someone on the phone and saying, this is what we found out, and that's basically in writing.
Which must be made in writing?
Well, or in email. You know, written times I do email. I do voice email.
Do you?
Yeah.
How
put
do
it
you
into
have?
Voice.
Say made in writing.
It's an app. You just use it, and then you put it in an email and
So, Senator Hall, Senator Dibble, would it accomplish your goals here if on line 3.11 before notification the word written is inserted?
If it works for that,
with the initial notification to the person is done in writing. I mean, it's unlikely that the agency is going to pick up a telephone and just call them and leave it at that, because they want everyone to know they complied with the law and they put it in writing. But
you'd think so.
If it would make you more comfortable, we can certainly put that in there.
All
right. Okay, Senator Hall moves on line 3.11. Before the word notification, insert the word written. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, the only part I hadn't gotten to was the penalty section on line 5.2, and that says that it just basically doesn't really change the penalty. It just refers back to the sections that we've buttoned up, guilty of a misdemeanor, and then. And then circumstances under which folks can be terminated.
All right, there is one other thing we need to do, which is to update the effective dates. So Senator Dietzick moves on line 4.35 to change 2013 to 2014 and to make the same change on line 5.10. Is that acceptable, Senator Dietzick?
Yep. So moved.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there any further discussion on this matter? Senator Hall, do you want to move the bill? Senator Dietzick, do you want to move the bill?
I move the bill. Three. He moves and passed and adopted and passed to the Senate floor.
It makes sense.
All right, Senator Dietzick moves that House File 183 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? Oh, I'm sorry, we do have someone interested in speaking. Before we take a vote, come on forward, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Burnson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I need to start by offering my deep apologies to the committee and to the author of the bill. In preparing for the meeting, I had been looking at the House file language as was posted on the website, not remembering that we'd be dealing with the language as it stood in the Senate last year. I apologize. The Section 1 of the bill, which is not in the, which was removed from the House file language, was not included in the bill that passed off the House floor. I want the committee to think about the idea of allowing an individual access to the name of persons who have obtained access to private data on the individual, in that there are a lot of private databases with private information held by government entities that don't track access and would be incredibly costly to modify those systems to track access for. And I understand the general principle that, you know, government entities aren't required to create data under data practices law, but the specific language in here about, you know, giving individuals the ability to find out who looked up their name or who looked up their private data, if that data doesn't exist, I think it's creating an expectation for citizens that may not always be able to be fulfilled. So I do deeply apologize to the author and to the chair for not raising these issues before the hearing. It was my mistake that of what language we were working off here.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Burnson?
So, Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you for your testimony.
I was surprised.
Senator Dibble.
This issue has been raised quite a bit. It was raised quite a bit last year, so I think it will continue to be the source of significant concern. It is a very significant administrative burden to local units of government. I don't have a great solution sitting here today. You know, and there may not be. This may be something that that folks feel strongly about.
How would you like to proceed, Senator Dibble?
Oh, I think moving the bill along is just fine.
Is any further discussion on the bill?
Senator Lance.
Senator,
where does
Hall
the bill go from here?
Back to the Senate floor. If it passes there and the House doesn't accept the Senate language, there'll be a conference committee.
And Senator Latz?
Senator Hall.
Does council have any thought on how we could remedy that situation?
Does council have any thought on how to remedy the issues raised by Mr. Burnson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, I think as Mr. Burnson pointed out, nothing in the Data Practices Act requires you to create data that doesn't exist. It's just to the extent the data exists, then someone has access to it. I mean, you could put comfort in language in there on page 1, line 22, for the period insert, or the data, I don't know if you want to say do not exist or may not reasonably be obtained or something like that, but...
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does our testifier have any thoughts on that?
Sorry, Ms. Pontius, could you repeat that?
I'm not quite here at all.
Ms. Pontius.
Or else on, let's see. On page 1, line 20, maybe after the comma insert, to the extent the data are maintained by a government entity.
Mr. Chair, our testifier, do you want to respond?
Mr. Burnson, what are your thoughts on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, I think what the advice from counsel is a good suggestion. Like I said, it's your policy decision whether you want us to provide names of who accessed this information. That's your policy decision. I just want the law to be clear to someone who wants that information that the expectation isn't in law that for every database we're holding with private information, a log is being kept of who's accessing it. I just my fear is just creating an expectation in the law, which I think adding some clarifying language would help with.
Senator Dibble, what are your thoughts on Ms. Pontius's suggestion language?
I think it may address the concerns that local units of government have brought to me. There's some larger issues, I won't bring them up right now, about the maintenance of logs and tracking who's accessing data and for what purpose. That's a shortcoming that was addressed in the legislative auditor's report. I guess I did bring it up. but I think that might at least go a step towards addressing the concerns of local units.
We have another person has miraculously appeared at the witness testifier's table. Do you wish to testify, sir?
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman. I'm such a small presence, too.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Don Gemberling, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, and somebody who wished to work for the state of Minnesota on this stuff for a lot of years. Before you go where you're going, I think you need a little information. One of the things I used to do for the state of Minnesota was I was in charge of security for the state central computer system, okay? A job that I didn't really like much, but it paid the bills. Since 1980, law has required the government agencies determine for access to private and confidential data, who within the agency, whose work assignment within the agency reasonably determines they need access to private or confidential data. I would submit it's kind of hard to do that unless you figure out who they are. Okay. Now, that's a requirement that's not in the Data Practices Act. It's in the rules implementing the Data Practices Act. You actually use some of the language from the rule in the bill. So you already got to figure out who you're going to give access to private or confidential, which of your employees gets access. And I would submit to you, if you don't keep track of who's getting access, you don't have any security. Because you're always going to be potentially the victim of, we don't know who accessed this stuff. Okay? So I understand the potential cost kinds of things. But part of what I'm thinking is, this should have been dealt with sometime in the last 30 plus years, 40 years now. 30. I wasn't any good at math either. Plus, from the standpoint of the local government entity, this may be why so many of them are getting sued under the DPPA, because they don't keep track of who gets access. So just wanted you to have that information. So,
thank you, Mr. Gimmer.
Questions, I'd be happy to answer.
So not seeing any questions. Thank you, Mr. Gimberly.
Thank you.
So, Senator Dibble, would you do you wish to have the bill amended to insert on line 1.20 the language after comma, to the extent the data is maintained by the government entity, comma?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Senator Hall, do you make that motion?
I'll move. Yep.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any further discussion? Any further commentary from members of the audience? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick renews her motion. House File 183 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, Senator Goodwin's going to take the chair. We're going to reorder the agenda a little bit. We're waiting on copies of the Uniform Collateral Consequences Act to be provided from printing downstairs. So we'll move on to item 3 on the agenda.
Are we doing 2152?
Just give them all there.
Yeah.
So we'll go to.
It's much harder to track.
Welcome to your committee, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. You're on to Senate File 2152 on housing courts, and I understand there's an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, that's what I've been told, too. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the author's amendment, which is A1.
Hardly have anything.
Changes the effective date.
Or it changes the effective date.
By making this deletion, members, the bill will become, if it becomes law, be effective August 1st, rather than immediately following the action. That will give the parties and the participants in the court time to adjust.
Sorry. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Senator Latz, your bill's in the order you want it.
Thank you. Madam Chair, this is a very simple bill. It provides for the district courts to operate their housing calendars utilizing almost exclusively referees. And for reasons of efficiency and expertise, That is the way that Hennepin County does it, the 4th District. So this is a part of the initiative of the entire judicial branch, I understand, is that right? But to testify on behalf of this particular bill, Chief Judge Peter Cahill is here.
Thank you. Go ahead, Judge.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, under current law, actually, party has a right to remove a judge in housing court, essentially to just make the demand and the referee is removed. Our proposal is that to remove that ability and so that the person has a referee in housing court. However, it does not remove the right to appeal to a judge and have a judge review the referee's decision. That would remain in law with this bill. It would also keep in place the right to remove a referee. It's just that you would get a different referee. In other words, every party has the right to remove a judicial officer just by filing a notice specific to that judicial officer. So that right would remain as well. So if a party does not like a specific referee, they can still file on that referee. The main purpose here is that most of the districts in the state of Minnesota are underjudged, and that includes the 4th Judicial District, where we don't have enough judges to cover the number of cases and the amount of time it takes. And with scarce judicial resources, we are doing everything possible to cover the work that we have. One of the ways that we do that in a very effective and, I believe, a very fair manner is to provide referees in our housing court. Housing law, as you know, is a very specialized, very technical area of the law and requires a fair amount of expertise to be able to rule efficiently. And we have hired referees who do this work on a day-to-day basis, are experts in the field. In fact, one of our former housing court referees wrote the book for judges. So judges in greater Minnesota who run into a housing issue pull out their bench book. It was written by a Hennepin County Housing Court referee. And the right to remove a judge is rarely exercised. Of the 7,428 landlord-tenant disputes that were filed in Hennepin County last year, there were only 79 judge demands. It's not enough to regularly schedule a judge to do these type of hearings, but it is disruptive because every time a judge demand is made, we have to find a judge, make room on their schedule in order to hear the case. And in housing court, the time limits matter. We're talking matter of days, not weeks or months. And so it's quite disruptive to the whole judicial process to be able to do that. Again, there is still that judge review if the parties don't like the decision of the referee. But because of the timeliness of the decisions that must be made and the expertise, it is much better to have the referees decide these cases. In bringing this proposal, I don't want in any way imply that these cases are not important or that the referees are inferior judicial officers. They go through the same training as judges do when they are appointed as referees. They are experts in their fields. They are analogous to a federal magistrate judge or to an administrative law judge and perform the same function, dealing with a type of litigation that has a very complex, narrow area. This would create a great amount of efficiency for the Hennepin County Housing Court by removing the ability to demand a judge at the first instance and to leave the judge in the mix, but only on a judge review process. That I stand for questions.
Thank you, Judge Cahill. Next on the agenda is, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, first I want to note that Senator Newman became an author of the bill as well after the bill was introduced. He's not present today, but I wanted to acknowledge that. Also, I think Senator Hall had a question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lance, one of my questions was if someone wanted to have a judge instead of a referee, does this give them the ability to do that, or is it just what they get?
Let Judge Cahill respond.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, if somebody were to demand a judge, this would take away the right to demand a judge to have that first hearing. It would still be a referee. They could remove the individual referee but not demand a judge. They could, however, if they are dissatisfied with the decision of the referee, file for a judge review, which is a fairly informal, almost like a mini appeal, does not cost extra money for a judicial officer, not a judicial officer, a judge, to hear the case, to schedule a hearing, to read the transcript, and to review the referee's findings and conclusions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hall. Next on the agenda on this bill is Doug Tooner. Mr. Tooner, welcome to the committee.
That's Doug Turner, T-U-R-N-E-R. I'm an attorney with a law firm of Hanbury and Turner, and I wanted to come to this committee to discuss and just to share my opposition of this bill. And just to give you a little background, I'm an attorney, and my law firm is made up of four people. We represent landlords and property managers and ownership. That's the majority of our business. It's work that we take seriously. It's work that we don't joke about, because the serious business of it, we're displacing people from their homes. And we have used in the past, just recently, the method by removing a referee, and we think it's important for not just landlords, but for both sides, both litigants, tenants as well. To keep the ability in the law for referees to be removed so you can get a district court judge. We believe that there are cases where district court judges need to hear the case, and that's because the law is complex, the facts are complex, we have difficult and complex litigants. We deal with people that may have disabilities, both physical and mental, just causes problems, and there are instances where we need judges to hear the case. I've read the summary by which the court believes there's this expenditure of time by judicial officers. I don't see that. Of the 79 cases, if you do the math, as they've presented it, it's 400 hours total on the 79 cases. That's 5 hours of judge time. And I'm assuming, and I don't know what a judicial unit is, but I'm assuming that's a law clerk, that's any other staff person that may be in that particular judge's purview. But I don't believe we spend that much time. And I just disagree with the fact that there is 5 hours of time, and this just seems like the place to cut when there's nothing before this committee to say what the number is. I look at the summary, and it looks like to me they reported from a 2009 summary report. And again, I think it's important to keep this matter in so that referees can be removed. If you look at the only other county that has a housing court program is Ramsey. They have one referee. All other counties, these matters are heard before judges. The amount of time that cases are heard in other counties with judges, I would present to you, can't be that great. And I say that because when we go to an eviction hearing, and I'm not going to try to bore you, the first hearing is an initial appearance. It's admit-deny. Do you admit or deny the allegations, and can the parties resolve it? Only then do the parties come back to the court if they can't get a resolution. Trials average probably 1 to 2 hours. I can't imagine that there's a huge block of time for these cases in eviction matters. And again, I submit to you, what's more important? I understand they think there are higher priority cases. Are murder cases more important? Absolutely. Are trespass cases more important? I don't think so. Speeding tickets, are they more important than housing cases? I don't believe so. And these are cases that we believe judges should sometimes hear, and it just doesn't compute to the savings that this bill and that the court is claiming are the savings. I believe, you know, I had a chance to talk with Drew Schaefer of Legal Aid, and he's not here today because he's having a baby. Hopefully it all goes well. They take no position on this bill. I know Mr. Bernberg's here, but I just really would like this committee to think about, again, this applies to not only my clients, not only large landlords, but the small landlord. The landlord that maybe thinks they didn't get a fair shake in front of the referee and they want a district court judge. Again, that happens. And having the ability to remove just doesn't correlate into this big expenditure of time. The minute you remove a referee, within 15 minutes to 45 minutes in Hennepin County, you go and see another judge immediately. And that judge says, is it resolved or not? And if it's not resolved, then you come back another day. So we take the position, again, that and there's no correlation. I mean, we don't know of the 79 cases. We don't know how many of those cases really went up to the Court of Appeals, got that was the final disposition of the case. So there really is, to me, no good way to figure out what dollars were actually saved, or did we create more dollars by having cases go to the Court of Appeals? So that's the position, I think, just generally that I wanted to express to the committee based on the language in the bill, and to not exclude this ability for referees to be removed.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. What was it again?
Turner. T-U-R-N-E-R. Turner. Thank you.
If you had the choice between referee or judge, which would you take and why would you take it?
You know, it's somewhat of a loaded question. My office, I've been doing this since 1997. I file a lot of evictions, probably somewhere between 30 and 50 a month. Some are really simple cases, non-payment of rent. We come to resolutions and people pay. Others get very difficult, and they get very difficult because you're dealing with people with mental disabilities and physical disabilities, and the law gets complex. So I think in the majority of the time, I agree with you, at least in Hennepin County, that I would probably use a referee. It's cheaper for my client. You do get a good result in most instances. But in instances where those facts are difficult and the law is difficult, we sometimes remove referees to get judges because we do need the judicial expertise. We need that judicial officer that is held accountable, right? I mean, that judicial officer at the district court level is appointed by our governor and then has the ability to run for re-election. My clients want sometimes the ability to know who that judge is. So maybe they want to go and express themselves at the poll the next time that judge comes up for re-election. So it's certainly important. And to answer your question, I think I'd say the majority of the time, referees in Hennepin are fine. But again, just taking that ability away all the time, we're just opposed.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Hall. I wonder if Mr. Cahill would respond to that. Is there a peace in the valley spot here we could come to? And do you understand his concern?
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, absolutely. The need for a judicial officer or a constitutional officer to be in the mix is important. That's why we are not trying to get rid of the mini appeal to a judge. For example, a complex case, that if someone is aggrieved, they don't like the referee's decision, they can then ask for the judge review. And the judge will review the entire record. In fact, at no cost to the parties, we'll prepare a transcript of the entire proceeding, and the judge will review that as part of their decision. And actually, I think I respect Mr. Turner's position on the complexity, but I think that almost argues for the referee because they are the experts in the area of law. I'm going to make the confession right here and in front of all the senators and the video camera that when a housing court case comes to me, the first thing I do is I pull out referee Labine's housing book because I'm not an expert and I know there are very detailed parts of the law I need to know. So I think the complexity argues for use of the referees, much as in the administrative law area, we use administrative law judges who are experts in very complex areas of the law. We should not, however, I agree with Mr. Turner, remove the constitutional officer from the district court level at some point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Cahill, thank you, Madam Chair. Are there times that you would make sure that you hear that case, or really there's no time that you'd want to hear a case like that, not because of the position, but just because of your expertise in that, where he's saying there are cases that you might look at ahead of time and go, okay, I need to take this case because there are some complexities here that I need to deal with. And that's why I'm looking at, do we need to have a judge review a case before the case versus after? I'm just asking questions.
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Hall.
Judge Cahill.
I'm just thinking out loud here. It is never, as chief judge, one of my assignments is to assign judicial officers to cases. If, for some reason, the parties agree that this is an extremely complex, unique, and if they ask for a judge assignment in my discretion as a chief judge, I can override that and say, yeah, this is precedent setting, it's so complex, and even the referees agree that they don't have the time to handle it. I could do that. But that would be in my discretion as chief judge under the chief judge statute, where I have the authority to schedule any case to any specific judicial officer. The parties would have to probably bring a motion to me or just call up and say, we'd really like this to be a judge for some reason.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Senator Sharon?
What is the cost to you have to file a form to appear in front of the court? What is the filing fee for this particular issue? Senator Cahill or Judge Cahill?
Mr. Turner.
Actually, Mr. Turner might, since he does it regularly, has to pay
all
for
right.
it.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. The cost for any district court matter when you're filing it, $322. Now, since attorneys have to e-file, if you're e-filing, there's a $5 convenience fee and a $2 technology fee, so it brings the total cost of $329. Pro se litigant, if they're not filing in forma pauperis, then the filing fee would be $322. The first time someone files a document, that's the filing fee.
And
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. And the filing fee covers what costs? The reason I'm asking this is I'm wondering if we're not using the typical procedural process, will there be a reduction in the filing fee? Is there a justification for a reduction in the filing fees for landlord-tenant disputes about evictions? Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, we would love a reduction in the filing fees. I can't answer what the $322 filing fee goes to or how it's applied. I know it goes to the general fund, and those monies are doled out accordingly. But as far as what happens to the $322 once they file it, I can tell you that the amount of time litigants spend in front of a referee or a judge compared to a standard civil matter is very, very minuscule. Very minuscule.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, that is the initial filing fee, as in any other civil case. There are no additional filing fees for example, the judge review. So no matter what happens with this bill today, the filing fee would remain at $322. I would caution, obviously it's up to this committee on how the general fund, how revenues come in. We really don't have a position on that as a branch. But there are so many different types of cases within the civil law context requiring various amounts of time. If we start to grade fairly finely on filing fees, it may be a quite a frustrating activity because there are other ones that are perhaps less significant, but then there are more that are complex cases, and do we charge even more for those to be able to account for the time? But that's revenue that's, to be honest, beyond the scope of my job.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill?
Chair, Paul Bernberg had approached it prior to the hearing to get on the witness list.
A question for the judge?
Yes.
Or
even Senator Brass, I'm not sure.
Okay. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think either Judge Cahill or Senator Latz is able to answer this. It appears to me that the legislation before still provides a judge to sort of review any of the any and all of the activity of a referee, and in the event that a party disagrees with the referee's decision, that they still have an ability to appeal to a judge. Is that true? And is it also true? So it's a compound question. So judge, give me the opportunity to ask a compound question. And do you believe that this process continues to provide a notion of objectivity to the in the process, along with judicial efficiency?
Judge Kale.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, from my point of view, and Mr. Bernberg might have something to say about that as well, I think it does provide that. We actually have a hearing. It is not another evidentiary hearing, but the judge has the people have a right to be heard to a district court judge. The judge does review the entire record, including the transcript. It is a quick, we try and turn those around in a month, get a decision out of the judge within a month to move things along. Again, we understand the need in housing court for timelines to be short. And so we do feel it is fair, and it does keep the district court judge in the mix. Actually, my signature goes on as countersigned all the referee orders. That's not the judge review. That's just my countersignature as chief judge that goes on those orders. And so if that got appealed directly from a referee, it would be my responsibility, which I'm willing to take. But I think Mr. Bernberg might be able to address your question as well.
Yes, please state your name for the record.
Sort of come in the middle here. My name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney at Homeline, which is a nonprofit tenant advocacy group. We do some litigation both in Ramsey and Hennepin County, as well other county courts. I don't think I have a lot to add to what the judge said, but Senator Champion, when an eviction case or a rent escrow case, a case that's going to be sent to housing court is filed, under present law, either side can ask for a judge, the judge demand. That's what's being proposed to be eliminated here. The loser of the case has a right to appeal. She can appeal either straight to the Court of Appeals or by judge review, which is essentially a sort of a mini appeal. The loser of a judge review, again, can appeal to the Court of Appeals if they like. Traditionally, most people who've appealed for judge review have figured they've had their second bite at the apple, are satisfied one way or another with the outcome, and don't go to the Court of Appeals, and therefore there's probably a cost saving to continue to have judge review. I don't know if I've answered your question. I was called on by the chairwoman to answer, so I tried my best.
Please remember to all the people that are testifying to sign into the sheet there, please. Okay, does that answer your question, Senator Champion? Any other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to say something besides that?
I did want to speak briefly, but Senator Champion has caused me to give half my talk. I'll try to be brief. I will be brief. I said who I am. The last biennium, there was a proposal by the courts to eliminate both judge review and judge demand, both of them. There was citizen input essentially from our office and from Larry McDonough, who was on sabbatical from being the head housing attorney with Legal Aid. Larry's not able to come today, but endorses what I'm about to say. Larry's now working as the head pro bono counsel at Dorsey & Whitney. We opposed that bill because we thought and still think that if you eliminate both judge demand and judge review, it raises constitutional issues. And secondly, because it eliminated, as already discussed, a simple appeal process that saves money and gives pro se people a chance for an appeal when the referee screws up. And with a few thousand cases a year, he or she is going to screw up. In its wisdom, the legislature, basically this committee, killed that bill, that portion of the bill. Essentially, they heard us. We are prepared to take yes for an answer. And when the answer is yes, we came here basically to say that certainly Homeline's mildly in favor of this bill. I think Mr. McDonough will be even more strongly in favor for the reasons stated. I think that's the only other thing I'd add is I think our my view and that of Mr. McDonough's is largely looking at it more from the point of view of a small guy as opposed to tenant versus landlord. And lastly, I think that the current system assumes that the referee is going to be even-handed, and there's an implied contract with the courts that the referees are chosen along those regards. And I think I've talked to Judge Cahill about this, and I think he agrees with that idea. That's all I have to say, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you. Sir, would you like to state your name for the record?
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Christopher Kalla, K-A-L-L-A. I am also an attorney at the law firm of Hanbury & Turner. Mr. Turner is my colleague. I just want to address a few things, Madam Chair. First of all, with respect to a judge review of a referee's decision or an initial judge demand, the review by a judge of a referee's decision is not a free process for the litigant. There is no filing fee, but there is a requirement that that litigant purchase a transcript of the referee trial. And that can run into several hundreds of dollars. In a multi-day trial, that could easily exceed $1,000. Those are costs that a litigant would not incur if the case were tried to that judge in the first instance. The second thing is that just because there is the availability of a judge to review a referee's decision, that doesn't mean that there's not going to ultimately be an appeal to the Court of Appeals anyway. If this bill is adopted, one of the offsetting costs that's going to be maintained is two reviews, the judge review of the referee's decision and the appeal costs after. A litigant who loses in front of a referee can appeal either to a judge or to the Court of Appeals. And if they appeal to a judge, they can still appeal that to the Court of Appeals as well. And one of the cost factors that the background summary doesn't address is what's the appellate process costs being avoided or incurred as a result of this legislation. That's not addressed. And if we're talking about 400 judge hours at the district court level on a 2,000-hour yearly work calendar, that's about a one-fifth of a full-time judge to handle all of these judge reviews. I don't know how many appellate court cases it would take to offset that, but this bill in the summary does not address those costs at all. I would propose that having the ability to request a judge in the first instance might actually eliminate some of the litigants appealing to the Court of Appeals when they lose. They will have potentially felt they got their day in court in front of a real judge, not to diminish the referee's stature, but some people feel a real judge is different than a referee to the point where if that's what the judge says, I'm fine with that. Lastly, one problem with the review of a referee's decision as opposed to the Court of Appeals process, there aren't any clear rules set out for how eviction actions are stayed for the posting of cost bonds. The Court of Appeals has very clear and developed rules to how to address a litigant's stature during the appellate process. That does not exist for the review of a referee's decision. And lastly, to address the complex nature of eviction cases, I'm not convinced that evictions are so complex in their procedural and statutory bases that district court judges aren't completely capable of handling them. We talk about complexity. We talk about also some social issues, fair housing claims, interactions with the federal courts with foreclosure actions. There are other concepts that can come into play in some of the housing court cases. And to address Senator Hall's question earlier, why would you choose to remove a case to a district court judge in the first instance? Some cases have those additional components that a litigant would feel that a judge who has been on the bench, who has tried over murder cases, who has tried complex civil cases, who has tried class action lawsuits, that judge might have a better grasp for some of the more complex nuances of an eviction case. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience like to come up? Senator Sheeran.
Was your recommendation that at the onset that the person be given a choice between a referee and going directly to the judge? Is that what you were proposing?
Yes, I oppose this bill because I think the litigants should be afforded the opportunity to choose either a judge or a referee as their rights exist right now.
And Senator Goodwin,
Senator Sheeran.
What, or maybe Senator Latz, when you think about that choice, from your experience, what do you think the likelihood is that a person, what would be the incentive to choose the referee as opposed to the court for someone seeking recourse under an eviction? Why would somebody, I mean, you give them the choice, why wouldn't they just go to the court all the time? Do we eliminate what you're trying to accomplish here with that? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
Before you answer that, I just have to say we have six other bills on the agenda, so we got to speed this one up. So,
well, then we should maybe lay it on the table because I have questions about this. I think it's important to understand what happens here. That's why I asked about the money. You could give an incentive to the referee if it was less to file for a referee, but always give them the choice of which is a person's right to appear in front of a judge. So that's why I'm asking the question. What would be, if you implemented the suggestion here, would in practice, from your experience, everybody choose to go in front of the court? Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll let Judge Cahill respond to part of that, but just to clarify, the current practice is that you get assigned by default to a referee now in Hennepin County, and you have a right, rather than going in front of the referee, to make a judge demand. And then your case will be heard in its first instance in front of a judge instead of a referee.
I see. So that exists right now?
So, yeah, that choice, in effect, exists right now.
And sorry, Senator Goodwin.
Senator Sheeran.
Is that just in Hennepin County or is that statewide?
It's Hennepin County. I believe Ramsey County operates the same way. Those are the only two counties that have specialized housing.
And Senator Goodwin, this would apply statewide, Sheeran, though, your proposal.
Yeah, the statute would apply statewide. As a practical matter, it would affect Hennepin and Ramsey counties at this time, unless other counties considered implementing housing courts with referees. Judge Cahill may have had something to add. Senator Sheeran.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Senator Sheeran, I was going to make the same point in the numbers. As I said, we have roughly 7,400 cases a year and only 79 judge demands. When current law is that you essentially can pick. It's not talked about that way, that you have a choice. It's assigned to a referee and you can object and get a judge. And so I think that low number shows the expertise that the referees do exhibit in handling these cases. The reason why there are not referees outside of the metro area is just because there isn't a critical mass to have to hire a judicial officer just to do that instead.
Okay, members, I think we're ready to vote on this. Senator Latz, you want to move your bill?
Sure. I move that Senate File 2152 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to Senate floor, I believe.
Yes, moves to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 2195, Senator Latz, and there is an author's amendment. Senator Latz, do you want to tell us about your amendment?
Thank you.
It would be the A14-0805.
Thank to Madam Chair. This is an author's amendment to the bill. It reflects a replacement language in Section 7 that has been agreed upon by the Hennepin County Bar Association and the National Association of Structured Settlement Buyers.
Any other's amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. On the bill as amended.
And Madam Chair, I'm advised that the bar people who are here are willing to waive their testimony so that we can move along. But I don't judge Cahill's going to step us through provisions. This is basically the judiciary branches.
Thank you, Bar Association.
Madam Chair and members,
Judge Cahill,
you have a slide deck in front of you, I believe, which might explain in general terms what our policy bill is about. It basically falls into three different areas. And again, for the record, my name is Pete Cahill. I'm the Chief Judge of the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin County. And more relevant to the policy bill you have in front of you is I'm also chair of the E-Court Steering Committee, since many of the provisions apply to that initiative in the branch. Our first area that we are looking to make changes is to improve the process for litigants, and that falls under three areas. The first is to add additional information to be submitted to a judge in structured settlement cases. A structured settlement, as I'm sure you're aware, is when someone, instead of receiving a lump sum payment to compensate them for their injuries, receive their settlement, which is payable over time. That person has the right to sell, essentially, their structured settlement and get a lump sum, usually through a company that specializes in such transactions. And the author's amendment was to change the language to language that was agreed upon both by the Structured Settlement Association and also the Bar Association. It's mostly technical language about transferees and payees. The gist of it is, though, that if someone has a structured settlement and sells part of it, usually sometimes for pennies on the dollar, the judge who's evaluating a second attempt to sell the rest of the settlement or the entire settlement if the first attempt was unsuccessful, that judge should at least know about what the history of the case is and whether parts of the settlement have already been sold off or have been attempted to be sold off in front of another judge in a different county. This is basically to provide as much information as possible to the judge to make a good decision. Some of the people who are trying to settle or sell their structured settlements are vulnerable. In fact, judges have appointed guardians ad litem to represent those people and to investigate, since the court does not have its own investigatory power. And because they are vulnerable, obviously the judge has to watch out for their rights as well as the rights of all the parties and make sure that it is an appropriate and fair transaction. And so Section 7 provides that the judge get that additional information. The second is that a request for a hearing in response to a harassment restraining order be made within 20 days after the petition is served. Current law provides that the demand be made within 45 days after filing. This actually would make it more fair because of the operative date. 45 days from filing, the problem is if the person is not served with that order until perhaps the 43rd or 44th day, they only have a day or two to actually file a demand for a hearing. This would change the operative date from the filing date of the hearing of the petition to the actual service of the petition. Once that person receives the petition, then they have 20 days to demand a hearing. The third area is to permit application of fine payment to restitution first, so that monies received by the court go to make the victim of a crime whole first before the fine payments. In State versus Knutson, the Minnesota Court of Appeals interpreted the statute to find that any money received by the court absent any other direction, must go to the fine first. The general practice and philosophy of most judges is that monies received should go to restitution to make the victim whole first and to fine second. This would essentially codify this in statute. The second area on the next slide are several proposals we have to further our E-Court Minnesota initiative. E-Court Minnesota is our change of business practice to be an entirely electronic court environment and an entirely electronic court record. In order to do that, there are certain things that are in statute which would require paper. For example, the requirement that a court seal be a raised seal, in other words, an embossed seal. Well, kind of hard to do that with a computer to have an embossed seal. That would be replaced with an electronic seal with the name of the court and the seal of the state of Minnesota. The second would be to remove the requirement for a notary on pleadings and affidavits that are filed with the court. I want to emphasize that this is only for documents filed with the court. This does not apply to deeds and other areas where notaries are used. It's simply for documents filed with the court. The various sections provide the procedure, which would be to change it from a notary to a signature that has a line above it saying, I declare under penalty of perjury that everything I've said in this document is true. And then the other sections, for example, amend the perjury statute to make that, in fact, perjury, to state falsely under such a signature line. And this is the type of signature line that is recognized in federal law and would be given full faith and credit in other states. The concern that judges have had and talked to me about is what if there's fraud or people are signing that without the notary. This has been done in a number of other states, including California, Kansas, Massachusetts, and our staff has reached out to the court administration in those areas, and they really have found no fraud that has resulted because of this. And realistically, you don't use somebody else's name to pay $330 to file a civil action that you're never going to follow through with. It's just not the type of area where identity theft is really used. And finally, is to permit e-service for certain probate cases. There is actually in statute a requirement for U.S. mail for a service of certain type of probate documents, where the practice now, both in probate and civil, is to exchange documents by use of e-service. And so this would permit the e-service for those documents and actually mandate it if the Supreme Court by order mandates that it be done by e-service. And the last area is to create efficiencies, is to provide the petitioners in an error and omission petition in elections, that those petitions be served on all the candidates who would be affected. The best way to explain this is, for example, if someone sues the county auditor saying that Senator Champion should not be on the ballot, current law is Senator Champion does not get served with that petition. Realistically, he does because the statute provides that anyone who the court orders be served shall be served. Well, the first thing the Supreme Court does is say, serve all the candidates. So serve Senator Champion and anybody else who is affected by this. It's pretty common sense, and it would get eliminate the delay caused by petition, goes to the court, court turns around and says, serve the candidates, then the candidates are served, and then we're back. Right from the get-go, upon filing of the petition, all candidates who are affected by this should be served. And with that, I understand the questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to add one quick point on
Senator
the
Latz.
Part relating to the harassment restraining order hearing. I would note under the current statute it's possible that a person might not even be served at all with the proposed restraining order within the 45-day time limit. If that were the case, then their right to request a hearing would be eliminated altogether under the current law. So changing the start of that time running from the date of filing to the date the petition is served guarantees that the other party that is the target of the restraining order in fact does receive service and has at least and has up to 20 days then to request that hearing.
Okay, we also have a testimony from Kevin Riesch. I said that right? You wait. Oh, that's right. Thank you again. Okay, so any questions for the author or Judge Kale? Seeing none, Senator Latz, you want to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2195 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. All right, next on the agenda, we'll go back to Senate File 1676, the Uniform Collateral Consequences of Conviction Act. And Senator Latz, I do believe, yes, there is an amendment. Is that your amendment, Senator Latz?
It is, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll be working out the unofficial engrossment. Let me see. Is there a time on here?
Sure.
amendment, I'm trying to find here, what's the number on the amendment?
It's
A5. It's the A5 amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm going to ask counsel who prepared this technical amendment to explain why we need it.
Madam Chair, members, the A5
Mr.
amendment
Backus.
Is technical. It takes a reference to the Department of Corrections Legal Services Unit out of the bill and inserts Administrative Law Judge. This is consistent with the changes that were made in the last hearing of this bill.
Thank you. Senator Latz. Oh,
Madam Chair, members will remember from our previous hearing that this bill
Senator Latz, we did not adopt your amendment yet, so we should do that first. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members will recall from our previous hearing that this bill is aimed to give persons that experience collateral consequences from convictions an opportunity to pursue their lives and livelihoods without being encumbered by that particular collateral consequence if, under the circumstances described in the bill, relief is provided. There were two basic categories of that kind of relief. One is a temporary and more prompt relief that's available, and the second one would be in the nature of a certificate of restoration, which would happen or could happen 5 years after collateral consequences occur. So it's part of the second chance legislation. We had a number of conversations in the last hearing about it, which raised some questions about making sure that we had a complete engrossment in front of us. We adopted a fairly complex amendment at the last hearing. So we wanted to have an opportunity to return with the committee to the bill, the members a chance to review all of the changes in one place, and also to follow up with any technical additional changes that needed to be made in light of our conversations, which we just did with the A5 amendment. We also wanted members of the public and other interested parties a chance to do the same and have an opportunity to comment on that. So I don't have any further testimony I'd like to offer other than to ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Senator Letts. Is there anybody that wants to testify on this? Seeing none, members with any questions? Guess not. Well, in that case, do you want to move your bill, Senator Latz?
I'd be pleased to, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1676 as amended be recommended to pass. And do you have where it goes from here?
It goes to Health and Human Services.
Be re-referred to the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The next bill on the agenda is Senator Carlson, Senate File 2174. I saw him a bit ago. Here he is. Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have Senate File 2174, which covers increased use of the Ignition Interlock Program.
Senator Carlson, would you move your mic a little closer? There's noise back here. I can't hear you. Thank you.
As a matter of fact, Madam Chair, I was listening to try to keep up to this committee from my office, and the audio was very bad. So it was quite some time between hearing the voices of people, and I think primarily we could hear the chair's voice, but not the testifiers.
Oh, thank you for reminding us. Please,
thank you for reminding
people
me
that
too.
Testify, please, when you do, pull the mic close to your mouth. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2174 is a bill which allows drivers to receive a restricted driver's license upon approval by the commissioner. and be enrolled in the Ignition Interlock Program. A restricted driver's license allows the commissioner to determine the time of day when the license holder may operate a vehicle. The Ignition Interlock system only allows drivers to start and drive their car after taking and passing a breathalyzer test. The newly eligible offenses that will be included are manslaughter resulting from the operation of a motor vehicle, criminal vehicular homicide or injury, and criminal negligent driving where alcohol or alcohol and controlled substances were a factor. Eligible for the Interlock program are drivers that they must meet all requirements to participate in driving, such as proof of installation of an interlock device, proof of insurance for a vehicle with an interlock device, and restricted driver's license issued by the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. With me, I have Ms. Jody Jody Oskarson and Joan Kapinski to further answer any questions and describe the initiative.
And who would like to start?
I think I will.
Please pull it closer. You've got a very soft voice.
Madam Chair, my name is Joan Kapinski. I'm the Driver Services Director. What this bill is asking for is simply a technical fix to provide explicit authority to driver and vehicle services to issue a limited license to those who qualify after being convicted of the offenses that Senator Carlson mentioned.
Thank you. Next, Joan Kapsinski. Let me get that because I have Polish in me. So Kapsinski. Is that right? Kapsinski?
No, this is Jody Oskarson.
You're Kapsinski.
Yes.
Okay. And you're Oskarson?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, please. Sorry about that.
I'm just here as from Traffic Safety just to talk about Ignition Interlock and that it's an effective tool that reduces the impaired driving, which creates a pathway to legal driving, and to answer any questions about Ignition Interlock itself.
All right, members, questions? I understand Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment to the bill I'd like to offer.
Senator Latz has an amendment.
I don't have my packet in front of me.
2174. Would you like your packet?
Tell me. I'm sitting at your desk, Madam Chair. Thank you. Madam Chair, I introduced a bill this year to make a minor correction to the ignition interlock provisions that we passed and enacted into law last year, relating to the ability of those who are convicted of criminal vehicular operation to take advantage of the ignition interlock program when their underlying conduct was alcohol-related. And what we did at the time is we included in the effective date provisions a language that it applied to crimes committed on or after the effective date. And in effect, what that did is made it impossible for everyone who is already out there and laboring under the license cancellation or license revocation relating to their already convicted CVO from being able to take advantage of the ignition interlock program, the whole premise of which is that it makes for safer drivers who are licensed and utilizing this technology. So the amendment that I would offer, the A2 amendment, will delete the application to crimes committed on or after the July 1, 2014 effective date and accomplish the main purpose of the bill that we enacted into law last year.
Any questions on Senator Latz's amendment? Senator Carlson, do you have any comments on it?
I fully support the amendment.
All right. With that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Now, we're working on Senate File 2174 as amended. Anybody want to speak on it? Anybody else in the audience or against? No? Seeing none? All in favor? Okay. Well, I'm sorry. We'll have to move your bill. Would somebody like to move? Senator Latz will move 2174.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2174 as amended be recommended to pass. And where does it go from here?
And it goes to the Senate floor.
and that'll be sent to the Senate floor.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
All right. Now we have Senator Latz, Senate File 2410. This is the last bill on the agenda for today.
For this afternoon.
Sorry, we got some more fun things going on tonight. Don't want to miss. Let's see.
You don't want to miss.
Madam Chair, we'll have to make sure we do not adjourn after this afternoon's hearing. We'll just recess until this evening.
Okay. Thank you for telling me that. Okay, Senate File 2410, Senator Latz, and I don't believe you have an amendment to this, at least not from what I have here. Is that correct?
That's correct, as far as I'm aware, Madam Chair. This is the Department of Corrections unsession bill. And to walk the committee through the bill, I'd like to invite the Commissioner of Corrections, Tom Roy, and his deputies as he sees fit, give you the details.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Roy.
Good afternoon, Senators, Madam Chair. To my far right is Terry Carlson, Deputy Commissioner in charge of our institutions, and she will be presenting as well.
Welcome, Deputy Commissioner Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senators, I told the House Committee this morning that usually we talk about matters of great importance when we sit in these chairs, and those matters can include suicide and mental health and life and death situations. And the nature of the unsession, of course, doesn't lend itself to the heavy issues. And what we will testify to is the existence of archaic language, programs that have disappeared, and superfluous statute. And Mr. Turner has prepared a very concise document that goes along with this presentation, and we can quickly go through our detailed page by page, but I think his reference is very useful as well. Deputy Carlson can start, and we will add as we go.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division. The first change that we have is on page 1, starting with line 118. This, as the document prepared by Mr. Turner states, it deletes an obsolete reference to inmates serving on boards of directors or holding positions. We used to have a program that was a partnership with a private entity, and they had this kind of structure. That program is no longer in existence, and the practice was unsuccessful. The second change is on page 2, line 2.24. It deletes a reference to the Minnesota Correctional Facility SOC Center, which is no longer in existence. The next change is on page 3, point 3.27. It references a PREPARE program as an acronym for a program that happens at the Red Wing facility. That program is no longer in existence. There are many other very valuable programs at that facility with different acronyms, though. The next change is on page 4, and it's at the top of the page, lines 4.3 to 4.6. This covers a program that we used to have with the University of Minnesota, training new probation and parole agents, and we no longer have that program.
Madam Chair, the next section 5 deals
Commissioner
with,
Roy.
Starting with the Interstate Compact for Adult Offenders, line 4.8. Going on into page 28, lines.
Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner. Would you cite that last one again that you just mentioned? That's on page 7, did you say?
I'm sorry, page 4, line 4.8, and it is entitled the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision.
Yes, thank you.
There are no changes. There are many changes, I should say, within this section, leading almost to page 28. through page 28 to line 29.13, actually. And all of that language 28. That has been improved in that section references the Interstate Compact. And the Interstate Compact is managed nationally by the Interstate Compact Commission, and we participate in that compact. And these changes in language reflect the most current language that the Commission has put forward, and our language becomes similar to the national standard. We're very confident then that all of this language meets the needs of that Commission, and we have a very active Interstate Commission with four legislative representatives on the Commission, and we review it quite regularly.
Listen, I'm one of those.
And you can sense the good work that's been done here, I'm sure.
Yes, I can. Thank you.
There are a few changes in juvenile compact administration as well. There's some very technical on page 29, and then also on page 30.
The juvenile compact, as you know, Senator, is a more recent occurrence, and the commission also has developed very specific language regarding the juvenile work as well.
Madam Chair, I'll just continue very, very briefly with the repealer, section 10, and go through these statutes as well. So 24.022, grants and aids to counties for adult detention facilities and programs. We, a long time ago, received federal money and to give to as grants to counties for this purpose, but we haven't distributed any money for the past 15 years, so this section can be deleted. The same is...
Oh, excuse me one moment. Senator Dziczek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question. So I am assuming you haven't distributed money for 15 years, but does that mean you also haven't received any money from the feds? So they're not... I just want to clarify that.
Madam Chair and Senator Dziczek, thank you for that clarification. Yes, that's true. We have not received federal funds for that purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The same is true for 241.0221, Juvenile Detention Service Subsidies Program. We have not distributed any funds to counties for construction of juvenile detention facilities in over 15 years. And the next is 241.024, designation of chief executive officers of state correctional facilities. This is just a redundant statute. It's covered in Minnesota Statute 241.01, subdivision 3, paragraph G. Penalty for unauthorized release of information, which is 241.34. That statute is also redundant and covered in data practices laws in Chapter 13 of Minnesota Statute. 242.37 and 242.56 are about juvenile programs. Actually, 242.37 was just conservation camp, and 242.56 is a work and learn facilities for youth. These programs are not in existence at the time. We have other programs within the state for juvenile facilities and juvenile programs at both the local and the state level, so we no longer need this statutory language. 243.18, work required. This is a statute that says all inmates are required to work. This statute is redundant as well, and this provision is covered under Minnesota Statute 241.01, subdivision 3A, paragraph G. And as I said earlier today in a different hearing, the next one is my favorite, actually. It's 243.64. We used to have the ability to acquire titles to land if a person couldn't pay their debt for purchase of farm machinery in our farm machinery program at our Stillwater facility. We haven't done that for a long, long time, and we have no interest in acquiring anyone's title to their land. So that can be deleted. 260.5 5.2 is a definition used in the Interstate Compact for juveniles, and these definitions and terms are obsolete in relation to the current compact. And then finally, 260.54, supplementary agreements, again, to the juvenile interstate compact. The language conflicts with the current compact, and so it can be deleted.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Seeing none, Senator Letts, do you want to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file number 2410 be recommended to pass.
Be sent to the Senate floor.
Sent to the Senate floor.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. All right. The announcements now at the end of this meeting. I do believe we start again at 6 o'clock tonight. Is that correct? Yes, we're going to recess, not adjourn, and we're going to start again at 6 p.m. Is that correct? Okay, and then we do have 16 bills on the agenda tomorrow, starting at 10 a.m., and Senator Latz is buying both lunch and supper. No, just kidding. And we'll stay until the agenda is done. Expect a busy week next week as well before the first deadline. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I am providing some dessert tonight.
Oh,
at 6 o'clock or a little bit before then for members and staff.
All right. Well, that's a good deal. Thank you, Senator Latz. Okay, we're recessed. Thank you.